Hi everyone, and thank you for listening to the Literacy Works podcast with Bedrock Learning. I'm Andy Sammons. I'm the Deputy Head of Teaching and Learning at Bedrock. And today we have, can't be described in any other word than a powerhouse in education at the moment, Hayley Hughes, who's kindly agreed to join us today. So before anything else, thank you for coming on. It's amazing. What a name to have got on our podcast. Thank you very much for coming on, Hayley. So first of all, there won't be many that don't, but just for those who don't, or if there's anyone out there who's been living under the rock for the last year or so, what do you do? What's your role now? Because obviously you've been a teacher in your career, but what's current for you at the moment?
Well, I just have to say, what a flaming introduction! First of all,
I think I'm going
to insist that my children and husband call me a powerhouse from now on, instead of mum. Love it.
Don't they already?
Yeah, well, not quite. Thank you for having me, Andy. I'm really thrilled to be here. I was a teacher for 16 years, an English teacher like yourself. I think that's mm-hmm. how we probably first met.
Yes.
So did that for 16 years, loved it, absolutely loved it. And then just basically moved sort of quite naturally really into teacher development and mentoring. So now I work at the University of Sunderland. I've been there for just over 2 years. So I'm mm-hmm. the teacher development mentor lead there. I'm a principal lecturer. As a non-academic, I had no idea what that meant, a principal lecturer, but it means kind of sort of between a senior lecturer and a professor. So sort of in the middle there, I have kind of a whole, mm-hmm. I'm SLT at university essentially. Mm-hmm. So I look after about 1,200 mentors from all over the world who have trainees at Sunderland. And in addition to that, I'm very proud to be Director of Education at a company called Iris Connect, which I'm sure mm-hmm. many of your listeners will be familiar with, because we work with about 4,000 schools in the mm-hmm. UK. And we are a video-based professional development platform for teachers. We do lots of coaching, sort of research into practice, and are just all about helping teachers get better.
Yeah, when I think one of my early schools used Iris, and the big word that was used there in the early days was transparency. It's all about, yes. let's not put people in a fishbowl. Let's actually just share what's good, and let's share development.
Exactly,
let's have it an open mind. And that's the key, I think, really. And you've also done lots of really interesting stuff about kind of higher level, reaching the higher levels, haven't you? And with people mm-hmm. with literacy, you've also got the YouTube channel, haven't you? Is that something that you've been working on?
Yeah, so I'm clinging on desperately to still being an English teacher through writing books, delivering workshops in school, usually with I hate the phrase, but more able pupils. Although I used academic theory with every set, every year group. Yeah. I'm still clinging on to that. I run a YouTube channel called GCSE Literature Boost, a Twitter page where I essentially read academic research on literature papers, and I distill it into really kind of bite-sized chunks for very busy English teachers to use with their students. I've got a book coming out about it very soon on A Christmas Carol.
Amazing. I mean, that's always the one I lean on when I talk in these things about English teaching. I just think that's such a beautiful text, and yes. we'll get onto that a bit later. The podcast is primarily, obviously it's called Literacy Works, and I want to kind of look at literacy through your lens, really. You work with mentors and subject trainers and things like that. Where does that sit at the moment in terms of, I like to think as a sector, we've moved away from literacy just being no one's problem, really. Someone gets given a TLR and off your pop, no one's interested. I like to think we're moving away from that. But what does that look like for teacher training at the minute? What does that look like for colleagues coming into the profession? Do you think, is it good? Do we need to work on more? What do you think?
I mean, I think we're always by its nature of the beast going to have to always get better at literacy, to be honest. I think we're a lot further along than I certainly was when I was training to be an English teacher all those years ago. Yep. And I think you're quite right. The really great organisations like the National Literacy Trust, brilliant teachers and researchers like Alex Quigley, I think have kind of pushed the envelope now, yeah. so that literacy is everybody's problem. It's not just an English teacher's, because you know yeah. as well as I do that, you know, 10-15 years ago, literacy was the sole domain of the English department mm-hmm. school-wide. So if there yeah. was ever any CPD or anything, and, and let's face it, there was very rarely any CPD mm-hmm. on literacy, it was the English department's job, that was it. Mm-hmm. And I think with the advent of that term, disciplinary literacy, we now see other departments taking ownership of that. And, you know, a big part of that for me is like increasing that academic reading in every single subject as well, and looking at sort of the key vocabulary. I think it was actually Alex Quigley who followed a student round. I remember him writing a blog about this. Yes, I remember this. Followed a student round and noticed like all the domain-specific vocabulary that this student was able to kind of get to grips with. But then when they left that room of that lesson, it was almost like that was the end of that.
Yeah,
that kind of vocabulary.
That concept.
They weren't able to kind of take it to the next lesson. And it's really interesting. I was working with a group of ECTs last week, and I had a science ECT in there and an English ECT. And the science ECT was saying that they have 8-mark questions in their exam, which for them is quite a big piece of writing. I did laugh and say, you know, ours is 40, but there you go. But the point of this is that she was kind of saying, she actually realized that her students are doing nothing but moaning about having to write that 8-mark question. Mm. And one of the students said, well, this is science, not English. So she actually took it upon herself to go into the English lesson and watch this same class and see how that teacher was able to draw really, you know, long, advanced, developed writing out of that student. So she was then able to go into science and say, I've seen you do it in English, and I know you can do it. So I think in terms of teach training, to kind of answer your question, really, I think more probably needs to be done. There is a lot more focus on literacy than there's ever been, I would say, in teach training. And I can only speak for my own setting in HE, because in SCITS, obviously, it's quite different again.
Yeah.
But there can always stand to be more, for sure. And I think it's about practical strategies. Like, we all know that literacy needs to get better, but actually, how do we do that in a subject-specific way? And that's the thing, because I feel like some of the frameworks are very generic, and we need that subject-specific input. That's so important.
Yeah, and I think that's what the next thing I was going to start to pull on really is around those specific. What does that look like on a specific subject specific level? What does that actually look like in a classroom? I spoke to Mark Miller about this in terms of operationalizing it, and I've been reading quite a lot of The Writing Revolution recently, and that's a fantastic book about. And one thing it really kind of promotes is the idea that grammar and grammar instruction needs to be underpinned by really solid knowledge as well, and you can't have one without the other. So that's why capital letters and full stops, that's important everywhere, but actually it needs to move beyond that. So do you think that's a specific part of teacher training, you know, is that something specific or what?
No, is the short answer, and it should be, and I'll tell you why. I think I trained to teach and did an English degree. I did a literature degree, like most English teachers, to be honest.
Yeah.
Almost every department I've ever worked in or visited has been majoratively literature specialists.
I did language, but I've got an interesting anecdote on that. I'll let you finish, but I've got an interesting anecdote.
No,
that
go
might
on,
be
you tell me yours first, because I think it'll lead into it.
Well, I say it's interesting, no pressure now anyway. But so basically, it wasn't until sort of my fifth or sixth year of teaching that I really understood the importance of, in a literature essay, of that very specific language around powerful introductory statements. So, you know, X writing in this area uses this text as a vehicle to verb the adjective, to expose the toxic, whatever it is. I think it's really important that, you know, that kind of language. And then you've got topic sentences, linking sentences, evaluative sentences, conclusions that open up with an evaluative statement and finish with a conclusion. You know, in some ways, X, ultimately, Y. And I think those very subject-specific ways of thinking, being and doing are so important to answer the question about what it means to be human, the exploration of the human soul, which is ultimately what English literature is trying to respond to. And I had to jump on that when you said there about it's not part of things, because actually it wasn't for me.
similar. I had zero grammar training, like, at all. I did my GCSEs in the late 90s in a period where, you know, that really wasn't, to be honest, part of the sort of syllabus at all. It was very literature heavy when I did my GCSEs. And then I then did English literature A-level, English literature degree. It was a split degree with media as well, because I wanted to be a journalist, and I did go on to do that for a few years. And grammar just wasn't part of my kind of training at all. And then I did a PGCE, and, you know, we were watching videos like Phil Beadle was making on Teachers TV about creativity and, you know, poetry and stuff, which was brilliant at the time. And then I sort of went into schools, and it really wasn't a big part of the spec that I was teaching either. But I would say in 2015, when that step was made for the new reforms for GCSE, and they were much more focused on kind of the nuts and bolts of grammar, and I started getting, obviously, the Key Stage 2 changes as well, and I started to get kids through, and I'll never forget it. He's actually quite a famous rugby player now, Jack Sinfield, God love him, son of Kevin Sinfield, legends.
We watch him at Headingley,
There you go, yeah. So I taught Jack. I taught loads of rugby players. Saddleworth is like a hive of famous rugby players. Okay. It's amazing. They grow them big on these moors. That's what it is. So I was teaching Jack Sinfield, incredibly intelligent boy, absolutely really? Amazing. Right. Yeah. So sporty and clever. I remember him saying to me about this sentence, "Miss, is that the predicate?" And I was like, and because I was very much as a teacher always of the school of, if you don't know, be honest and let's learn together. So I said, "I'm not sure, Jack, what's a predicate?" So he had to explain it to me. And that was then that I had like a bit of a slap in the face, to be honest, and was a bit like, oh my God, my kids know more than me about grammar. Yeah. So I've got to go away and do this. And I think there are people fighting this good fight. If you think of the sort of brilliant book that's come out of Jenny Webb's and Marcello Giovanelli's book about grammar teaching, it's so technical. I remember trying to start reading it once on a train at 11 p.m. coming back from London, and I had to put it down because I was just like, oh, my head hurts. But it's so technical, but so brilliant, and it makes so much sense. And, I there's this dichotomy on Twitter of like, oh, if you teach grammar, you're against creativity. No, guys, come on. I'm the most creative person going, you know. But at the end of the day, we need that knowledge as a foundation for creativity. So I think more needs to be done. I think, you know, in that subject specific way especially, and that's why we need really great literacy leads from across the full spectrum of subjects. I was really lucky in my old school that we had a really amazing literacy champion in science called Emma Tiffany, and she basically used to do reciprocal reading. She led whole school CPD on it, and it was great to see a science teacher up there. And we had mathematicians doing the same, because you always get from math teachers, oh well, you know, it doesn't work in our subject. But it's about finding those early adopters in schools who are able to champion it.
And I think one of the things that I found, and again, it's an obvious thing because I'm an English teacher, but I think what I found when I started to teach pupils how to have that voice and to find that voice from a literature essay, it was, as you alluded to before, you teach literary theory not just to top end pupils, you're teaching to the full spectrum. I think what you're doing, and I said this when I spoke to a school the other week, it's about giving pupils a voice in your discipline, you know, kind of ingratiating them into the gang, and they might only do it until year nine, then drop it, and that's fine. It's about giving them as many different flavors, as many different opportunities and exposures and ways of being, because, you know, it's been, I was chatting to a geography teacher, it's been 20 odd years since I stood in Richmond Market Square and interviewed people about the co-op and how that changed their shopping habits as a geographer. I haven't done that for 20 odd years. And actually, geography teachers have those experiences layered on top. They've been to university, they think like a geographer. But let's give as many pupils as much as possible the chance to be part of that gang. And I think you're right. It's about finding those early adopters. It's about finding those people who are going to say, yeah, this isn't just about, oh, I'm going to walk around the science department and highlight people's lack of full stops. It's about, no, how can I, in my subject, help young people to speak and think like a scientist? Even a math teacher, for example, who might be thinking it's not relevant for me, What about those really long-winded questions? You know, Abra has 6 dogs, Tiffany has 12. How many months are there in a year, and days are there in the 12th month, or whatever it is? That's literacy as well. That being able to tackle those things is really important, isn't it? So, are you saying that you think there should be more, almost by edicts, you know, forcefully into teacher training? There needs to be something on, if not, then something very close to disciplinary literacy.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there is in every single course you will find, because in ITT now, we are all kind of led and guided by the learn how to statements in the core content framework. And we're inspected on that by Ofsted.
Right.
So if there was no literacy in, ITT courses, quite frankly, would be sort of in a category. So we are doing it. But I think also that then needs to carry on in that golden thread into the first 2 years of teaching, as well as an ECT. So it's that's on the schools as well.
But what does that look like?
That's really important.
What does that look like in a university setting for teacher training? When it says how to statements, what does that look like? What does that feel like?
So for example, in the core content framework, it's the same as the early career framework. The only thing that's different is the learn how to statements, because it's based on this kind of step up. So, you know, as an ECT, you'll be expected to be doing things yourself rather than relying on that modeling and deconstruction that you get in the core content framework as a trainee. So for example, it might say, learn how to improve students' literacy by focusing on reading or decoding texts or something like that. So, I mean, that's not the specific learn how to, but it takes that kind of approach. So as a university, it's then up to us, or as a teacher training provider, it's then up to us to actually integrate that into our curriculum. So how do we help teachers be able to do that? So it's almost working backwards like you would from a scheme of work from a GCSE spec.
I think we're really getting to the heart of it now in terms of what that starts to look like for teachers who are experiencing coming into the profession for the first time. I think that's really important. And the other thing I wanted to ask really was, we touched in our pre-pod conversation around research literacy. Can you unpack for us what that is and what that looks like for the sector as well?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things to kind of focus on here. I think, when I train to teach, I don't really feel like I was a research literate teacher at all. I just kind of was sent on my way, and teaching for me was seen as like a very practical subject. Don't get me wrong, in my PGCE I had the same diet as anybody else, a bit of Piaget with a bit of Vygotsky and a bit of Bruner and a bit of Skinner and behaviorism. We did all of that, but we weren't really encouraged to bridge that kind of knowing doing gap, as Daisy Christodoulou talks about. And that was what it was. You learned a little bit about it at uni, and then you went off to do your placement and you kind of forgot about it. I never once remember thinking, oh yeah, this links with Skinner's work on behaviorism. I just didn't do that. And then I reckon for probably the first 10 years of my career, to be completely honest, I was too busy immersed in kind of the life and the cognitively demanding environment of being a teacher, especially one in a special measures school, which is where I was, to think really about being research engaged or research led. Of course, we can never be a wholly research based profession, because it's not medicine. Sometimes people liken teaching to medicine, and I get why they do that, but it's absolutely not the same. I can give my daughter Calpol and know that it will bring her fever down. I can use a strategy with my year 9 class on a Monday and think I've cracked it, and then on a Friday it falls flat on its face. Teaching can never be that, but we can be research led, best bets, as Dylan William calls it. I started getting research engaged, and this will be unpopular with some people, but because of research ed. I started to go to research ed national conferences in about 2015. Loved and relished the idea of sitting in teachers' CPD sessions, who were talking about stuff that they were doing in their own schools and classrooms that were really working, that were based on research, and they were bridging that gap for me. Then I started to read more research myself. I did a master's in psychology, and was given access to a university library, because I think that's one of the big problems as well. Teachers don't have access to academic journals. They're all behind paywalls. paywalls, and I started to get more engaged myself. I think we're in danger now, because I think since COVID, the pendulum swung to the other way, where I think there's so much academic research now that it's like a smorgasbord. It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet. And personally, if I see an all-you-can-eat buffet, I see it as a challenge. And I think that's what teachers are doing at the moment. They're probably consuming research at a hugely crazy rate and actually not implementing much in a really, you know, with fidelity, basically.
Yeah, I was chatting to a really good friend yesterday who, and I was asking him how about his role, and he was saying, well, one of my things is knowledge organisers. And I said, you know, that's a really interesting topic, isn't it? Because it seems so simple. But actually, in some ways, they can do more harm than good, I think. And I know that might be controversial to some people, but I think anyone can Google Macbeth knowledge organizer PDF.
Yes,
but actually,
agreed.
you're not, I just think it's so important to be able to sit down yourself or sit down with a colleague and think, no, what's the really powerful basic knowledge? What's the really powerful underpinning theoretical knowledge?
What are we using it for? You know,
Go home and quiz on it. Well, how do they quiz? Go home and test, you know, they don't do it. You need to be really explicit about it. And I mean, obviously, for those people who listen to the pod regularly, this isn't a product pitch, this podcast. But one thing we use, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. I'm asking Hailey this for the first time, and I'm not told I'm going to ask her this. We have something called Bedrock Mapper, which is basically a repository of over 33,000 pieces of subject terminology and knowledge across 38 different, it's mad. And what you can basically do is you can select your words, and then pupils are pre-tested on it, then they're given a pupil-friendly definition, comprehension, synonym antonym exercises, image. It's all research, you know, underpinned by the research of Mazzano on vocabulary teaching. And what teachers do is they can, on their own or with colleagues, they can sit down, they can sequence the vocabulary that they think is important as a pre-teach, as a co-teach, as a revision exercise. And I think that's really important to have that knowledge that pupils can have made available to them at a time when the teacher chooses.
Yeah.
And I would rather have that than I would a quizzing platform, for example, that pupils, you know, go and do. Because actually, I think there's no guarantee that if you buy a quizzing platform in and you quiz on stave one of A Christmas Carol, who's to say that's going to be the same knowledge as the knowledge that you're going to teach them on stave one?
Yes.
Stave one's, you know, I think if you were to say misanthropic, callous, Malthusian, if you agree on those 5 to 10 terms, you're limiting the work for the pupils, you're limiting the work for yourselves, because, you know, you're managing that. What are your thoughts on that as a concept? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good idea, because, I mean, the whole kind of point is, and it goes back to that idea almost about like lethal mutations in a way of research. And I think we're really guilty of that in schools at the moment.
Yeah.
And knowledge organisers are one of the things that I would put under things that have probably become lethal mutations.
Yeah.
I mean, so having that kind of tool would be really, really useful. I mean, on knowledge organisers, I mean, I was a member of an English department at that time, and I'd stepped down from being a middle and senior leader and was working with the head of English at the time, who, to be honest, wasn't very effective, in all honesty. And then she knew she wasn't, so she ended up stepping down herself anyway. You know, we were all told, right, we all need knowledge organisers for every single scheme of work. So we all went off and downloaded them off Tess. You know, and were the things that were in that knowledge organiser mapped to our curriculums? Probably not, because we were all told we needed them today. And again, what did we do with those knowledge organisers? Not much, to be honest. They were superficial quizzing homework set so that we could be seen to be doing something with them. They were stuck on, you know, the front cover of the inside front cover of their exercise books to tick a box, you know, and it's not great. And dual coding, I would say, is another one of those. You know, my goodness me, PowerPoints are dual coded to within an inch of the life now. So much that actually the whole point of them being invented was that split attention effect, and they're actually causing cognitive overload. There's that much of many of them now. I mean, I think research literacy is a massive, massive issue.
Yeah, and I think exactly. And there's almost a place in schools, maybe for the teaching and learning lead, literacy leads, SLT, to kind of take point on that almost. to kind of think, well, do you know what are we, how are we going to make sense of this for our school community? What does this look like for our young people? What does it look like for our teachers? What does it look like for our, you know, for our parents? And so there is a big piece around that, isn't there, around education, research, literacy, which sort of leads me on to another really interesting thing that you started speaking about before, which was about, and I think you've got a new book coming out, this about around complex academic theory you mentioned. So how does that tie into disciplinary literacy for you? And let's not be ashamed of this. Let's stay in English. Let's talk about Christmas Carol. You know, tell me about that for your subject, rather than just, you know, how to write essays. What's going to be special? What's different about your book, and why have you chosen to write it?
Yeah, so I mean, it comes from really the fact that I think, as I've examined GCSE literature for a number of years for AQA, and it comes down to what I would see as a worrying trend of literature responses that are written like an English language response, where it is literally focusing on only language. So, you know, the overquoting, constant overquoting. I know this because it says the word X could mean this, it could also mean this. I mean, it's so mechanical. And I was never taught literature like that. For me, literature is about concepts, it's about big ideas, it's about, you know, authorial intent. About context and how that shapes our understanding, about themes, about golden threads, about patterns, about character development. If language is part of that, great. But if it's not, then I've seen some grade nine responses which have got like no quotations or maybe two or three words in the whole thing. And this is where that came from. So a few years ago, I was teaching an incredible top set of students. So we're talking probably 6 or 7 years ago now. And it was just at the change of the new spec, and all of my school were doing Jekyll and Hyde and Macbeth. And I decided, I'd taught this class for 2 years prior to this and knew them really well. It's such a gift when you get a class for like 4 years. I knew this class really well. They were fiercely political, so I decided that I was going to take a risk and I was going to do Julius Caesar with them. I'd never taught it before, so it was great for me because I could go away and actually, you know, inject my subject knowledge, do loads of reading. And it's a time when Donald Trump had been elected and things as well, Brexit had just happened, so it, you know, it was really political, engaging time, loads of links with Julius Caesar. So I did that, and I decided to take a massive risk and do Great Expectations, because everybody else was doing a book that was like that big and I was doing a book that was like that big. So I made them read it over the summer, and basically provided like weekly quizzes over the summer to make sure that they were reading it and all the parents were completely on board, because they all wanted to get like grade nines, you know. It came from that really, and having to kind of read a lot of journals myself to get up to speed with sort of what the, you know, what the key knowledge was in these texts, what the big ideas, what the themes were. And I thought, why am I not sharing some of this with my kids? Why am I limiting them? Why am I capping them? Because for me, you know, critical theory brings literature to life. And that's not to say that what we should be seeing in literature responses is, now from a Freudian perspective, from a feminist perspective, that's not what I'm doing. I use these academic theories basically as a springboard to ideas. So they can refute them. They can read something and go, oh, that's a load of rubbish. And what I'm doing then essentially is what, you know, Robin Williams talks about in Dead Poets Society, and Walt Whitman says, I'm encouraging my kids to have a voice, you know, to yawp their voices over the rooftops, to contribute to life's story, to have an opinion. And that's what it's all about for me. And also, what's the harm as well in them having access to really well-written academic criticism to be able to emulate some of that style themselves and really sound like an English scholar?
I think those things as well, what they do is they open up for teachers and colleagues their own understanding as well of a text. It opens up your own way of thinking, your own planning. You might not even mention an academic's name, but it's just giving you an alternative perspective on a text and things. And I think it's really important, and that again, it kind of links back to your idea on research literacy. And I just wonder whether this over languageification, if you like, of the literature exam has come from this, you know, this fear of exam results, this fear of how you can hit, you know, this is what happens, isn't it, when you get this regular sort of, you know, everything is assessed within an inch of its life. And I there's a place for accountability, of course there is. But if you, someone said somewhere, if you say the word X means, then you're honing in on language. Some markers might reward it, I suppose. I don't know. But then we need to come away from that, don't we? We need to move towards giving the pupils a voice. But as you say, it's a brave person to tell pupils they don't need to have quotes in their essays. As a brave person, that.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, like, that I'm absolutely not saying to students, oh yeah, don't use quotes, you know, don't shoot me. But what I am saying is that we shouldn't be overly reliant on quotations all the time in literature. And what I'm saying is as well, that actually it's, I think the reason all of this kind of over languageification, if that is even a
word.
Trademark, is I think because a lot of teachers, there wasn't much, you know, kind of notice about what the spec would be. I mean, I remember waiting for it for ages and it coming out dead last minute.
It was a big thing, wasn't there?
It was. And we haven't had like really high quality training on it. And I think people have kind of just done their own thing and maybe panicked a little bit.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the best responses I've seen have only had like a couple, for example, tracked Scrooge's character across the text by looking at sort of particular words he's used, that Dickens has used to describe his movements or his mannerisms or his thoughts, and they only need to be tiny words, you know. And I think it's that focus on actually we don't need to flood an answer with quotations. Let's pick the best, most juiciest ones.
But it's really hard, isn't it, with pupils? And I've had this before with all manner of pupils, all manners of prior attainment, and some of them say, you know, the famous, I've got how many quotes do I need? And all of it's rooted in fear of what do I need, you know, that sort of performativity versus actually let's get out, let's think about deep understanding and deep sort of, for want of a better word, spiritual engagement with the text. I think it's really important to kind of think about literature in those terms, and this is what I mean when I talk about disciplinary literacy, ingratiating pupils into that club. I think we have to ingratiate pupils into that club. I think that's so important. When's the book coming out?
Well, spring. So it's currently in with Routledge. I'm just waiting for the cover options to come along. It's gone to the editors now.
Nice.
And it's going to be part of a series. So it's the first in a series. So the next one is on an Inspector Calls.
Oh, my goodness. Amazing. I don't teach anymore at the moment anyway, but I will definitely be buying that.
Incredible.
Thank you so much for your time today. It's been so lovely. I know this is going to be a heavily downloaded podcast. I know that people are going to want to hear from you. So thank you so much for your time. I think there's some really important threads here around, you know, operationalizing how we can get this stuff into schools, into classrooms, so that students and young people can find their voice. Because this is something I've discovered recently. I think it's so important for the time that a pupil studies a subject. I mean, for example, I hated DT at school.
Yeah.
And I dare say that I wasn't particularly engaged and wasn't a particularly great student to teach. But I wish that I had, and I wish that my teacher had perhaps engaged with me a bit more to try and get me thinking like a designer technology professional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to that level, I wish that I'd had that relationship. And I think as much as possible, if pupils aren't going to take your subject beyond a certain point, that's fine. It's not the point. The point is to give them as much exposure to as wide a different amount of disciplines as possible, and that's where I think disciplinary literacy has got to offer us.
Me too.
And I think your new book and the work you're doing and the way you speak about things is helping that along the way. So
thank you
on behalf of everyone. Thank you very much, and it's been a real pleasure speaking to you today. And thank you so much. We'll be in touch.
Thanks, Andy.
About the launch. All right, take care.